third and last case, an easy case of statutory interpretation, number 23-12533, Perfection Bakeries versus the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store International Union.
Please, the court. The fund's method is not the best reading of the statute because it applies the prior partial credit against the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits rather than withdrawal liability as the statute directs. And simply put, in statutory interpretation, when a reading is not the best, it is not permissible. Now, our briefs go into some detail about the merits of the issues and how the fund's interpretation conflicts with the plain text of the statute, including two defined terms. It runs counter to numerous canons of statutory construction and blatantly ignores the fundamental and dispositive difference between the terms withdrawal liability and allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits.
Part of your argument, it's not all of it, but part of your argument is that this, the other reading of the statute leads to what you, I think, label an absurd result, because if you have this so-called credit, in your case, for example, the credit ends up being zero, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Are there cases where this method will, and I'll ask your opponent the same thing on the other side, are there cases where application of this method, the way it was done here, would lead to the credit being worth something?
Yes, Your Honor, there are, but I've...
Then why in the abstract, on that aspect of your argument, I know it's not the only part of your argument, but on that aspect of your argument, why is that reading of the statute, why does it lead to an absurd result? If it just happens to be your case where you get zero help.
I don't know that I would say that it's absurd. I would say that it's not the best reading, and I'll explain why, Your Honor. I did say that it was illusory, and I do stand by the fact that I think it's very largely illusory, and in most every case it would be illusory, and it is in this case. And that's because but in any event, it places the two adjustments in conflict with one another, and I'll explain that now. The 20-year payment cap and the annual maximum annual payment place a ceiling on the amount of withdrawal liability that can be properly charged to any withdrawn employer. Those work together to make a maximum amount that's payable in any instance, including in this one. And that amount that's above, the amount of the allocable unfunded vested benefits that's above the 20-year payment cap is thus never payable, unless you have a mass withdrawal, which is not the case here, but it's never payable. So it's not an amount for which any employer could ever be liable. The amount of the credit, to focus on your question, Judge Jordan, is either going to be smaller than the amount above the 20-year payment cap or larger. If it is smaller, then the credit is entirely illusory, and that would be the case in most every...
Well, let me ask you about this, because that cap seems to be doing a lot of work to your benefit here in reducing the amount of liability. But is that cap always going to be so substantial? I mean, the 20-year liability, I forget all the words to the cap, but... couldn't there be a situation where someone doesn't benefit to the extent that you do from a cap, and having the reduction on step two actually does make a meaningful benefit?
Sure, Your Honor. The 20-year payment cap does not always apply.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, and, isn't it just that it's just so much unfunded? There's just so much unfunded liability here that you just you know, the fact that this credit is taken off step two doesn't really matter because there's just so much unfunded liability left over that the cap gives you a great benefit by capping you so you don't have to pay all that unfunded liability.
Yes, Your Honor.
So someone without so much unfunded liability, though, they would benefit from the cap on a one-to-one. I mean, they would benefit from the credit at step two on a one-to-one basis, right? On a dollar-for-dollar basis.
To return to what I was saying before, if the credit is smaller, then no, they would not. You have to compare those amounts. And if it's,
well, I'm sorry. That's where I was confused. Why does the credit matter? Isn't it the amount of the unfunded liability that matters?
Indirectly, because that amount that's above the 20-year payment cap is what I'm comparing the credit to. Because, as I said, that amount is never payable. And, Your Honor, the credit is either smaller than that amount or larger. If it's smaller, the credit is entirely illusory. It's eaten up entirely by amounts for which the employer would never be responsible.
And maybe I don't understand the way this works, but it just seems to me like this problem that you have where you're not getting the benefit of this credit is just a problem because you have so much unfunded liability. If you didn't have just such a radically large amount of unfunded liability, then you wouldn't have this problem.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would...
So is this like a unique problem just to pension plans with just radically large amounts of unfunded liability?
Yeah, in recent years, definitely. They have gone largely over the cliff, and this unfunded vested benefits have gone over the cliff with it. And many employers were faced with this, but that's why the 20-year cap was so important. That is how Congress got the act passed in 1980, was that compromise of... No employer will ever be responsible for more than 20 years of this maximum payment. As I referenced in the brief, it set a ceiling. So that ceiling is what the credit is properly applied to.
Yeah, so let's address that. So I guess it seems to me like your best argument, and the one you led with, was the definition of withdrawal liability. That the credit language in, 1386, uses the word withdrawal liability. And then this calculation is to assess withdrawal liability. I guess, just to push back on that a little bit, when I look at 1381B1, that has the, you know, it says the withdrawal liability of an employer to a plan is the amount determined, you know, unfunded vested benefits adjusted, and then it has the A first, next, then finally. This doesn't look like a definition of withdrawal liability. It just looks like a way to calculate it. So why, I guess it seems like you're approaching withdrawal liability in 1386 as if it's some kind of defined term, but it doesn't look like it is a defined term.
Well, it's not defined expressly, but it is in effect defined by that formula, because all I'm trying to do is draw a distinction between the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits, which are determined under 1391, and then the amount of withdrawal liability, which is not known until you go through the four adjustments to the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits.
So maybe, and this again may be remedial, but maybe to Judge Brasher's question, if 1381 is a method for calculating this withdrawal liability, and it specifies four sequential steps, and the partial adjustment is not factored in at step two, as they say, then aren't you, as they allege, sort of adding a fifth extra textual step? I mean, finally, you know, sub D says finally. And you sort of want to say, like, not quite finally, because there's one more thing we've got to do.
No, I would say it is final, Your Honor, because it's the final adjustment to the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits, which is exactly what 1381B1 says. It says you take the amount determined under Section 1391, which is the unfunded vested benefits, then you adjust it four ways, and the final adjustment is in Section 1405. Now, that is the withdrawal liability. 1386B1 then says the credit is applied to reduce the amount of withdrawal liability. And I would point out, Your Honors, that the credit is actually based on the amount of withdrawal liability from the prior withdrawal. And the fund does not argue and in fact applied the credit as the amount of withdrawal liability. That is the amount that it was capped by the 20-year payment cap, the amount at the end of that conclusion. It didn't say the amount of withdrawal liability is really the unfunded vested benefits and use the, you know, the high millions of dollars number then, it took the final result and said, that's withdrawal liability. And if you look at 1386B1, it says withdrawal liability in both places. Any withdrawal liability of that employer for a partial or complete withdrawal from that plan in a subsequent plan year shall be reduced by the amount of any partial withdrawal liability for a previous plan year. Those phrases have to mean the same thing. And the fund says the credit is withdrawal liability. We all agree on that. But the number that you're applying it against, that withdrawal liability is actually the unfunded vested benefits.
One of the things that the fund relies on and the district court focused on too was that under 1381B1B, the reference to section 1386 is not a reference to any of 1386's subsections, but the 1386 as a whole. And they contend that district court concluded that that's a problem for you because it's not just subsection A that's referenced in the section. And I know you do it in your brief, but I'd like you to address that issue.
Sure, Your Honor. That is, I think, the one point where this actually is like, okay, there's something that you could look at there from the other side because it does reference just 1386. However, bear in mind that it says, in the case of a partial withdrawal in accordance with section 1386, you have to look at that first phrase, in accordance with a partial withdrawal, which, as I mentioned, is defined. It's defined right below that as a partial withdrawal as described in section 1385.
But doesn't 1386 in A and B sort of bifurcate the universe of partial withdrawals between what I'll call present partial withdrawals and previous partial withdrawals, A, B?
Yeah.
And so when in 1381B1B, it refers to the 1386 in gross, why wouldn't we read in the case of the partial withdrawal to refer to all partial withdrawals, both present and previous?
Because and I do say this in my brief too, but in section 1386A, it specifically talks about the amount of allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits determined under section 1391. It's identical to the language in 1381B1B, which is the second adjustment. And the section 1386B2 specifically says it applies against withdrawal liability. Every one of those adjustments that's under 1381B1B says specifically that it adjusts the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits in the referenced statute. 1386B2 is completely different.
I think that's your strongest argument. But this is like a recipe for withdrawal liability, right? It says like withdrawal liability is the amount to be determined under this title. It is the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits, then adjusted A, B, C, and D. I guess this is not, for example, this doesn't say withdrawal liability is defined as unfunded vested benefits adjusted in this way. It's kind of like a recipe to get to withdrawal liability. If I see it that way, why does the reference to the word withdrawal liability in 1386B really matter all that much? Like, it's still saying that any withdrawal liability of that employer shall be reduced by this amount. If you put this amount in step two, isn't it still reducing the withdrawal liability?
No, Your Honor, and that was the point that I was trying to
make. But I guess, well, why isn't it, though? I don't understand.
Because the withdrawal liability has been capped by the 20-year payment cap, which is...
Well, that's only in, like we've said, that's only in certain cases where there's just massive unfunded
liabilities. Sure, but in every case, you have to go through those four adjustments before the unfunded vested benefits actually become withdrawal liability.
That's if you look at that as a definition, I guess. I guess my point is, if I can't think of a really good hypothetical, I've tried really hard to think of a really good hypothetical, but when it says any withdrawal liability shall be reduced, let's say you started with four, let's just use numbers. These are not going to be very good numbers because I don't do math very well, but just if you start with four unfunded vested benefits, and then you do first, you reduce it by one, second, next, you reduce it by two, You know, then you reduce it by an additional one. Then you reduce it by additional one. Haven't you reduced the withdrawal liability?
No, Your Honor. Respectfully, you have reduced the amount determined under Section 1391, which it expressly says is the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits. It's
so
like a tax
you've only
deduction.
Reduced the, you only reduced it because you haven't, the withdrawal liability has not been reduced because the only thing that you can reduce is the thing you start from. That's your point?
So under 1391,
you start from unfunded vested benefits, and then every reduction is to that. You can't, okay.
Correct, Your Honor. Even if you go to Section 1405, which is the final reduction, it says it's a reduction to the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits that has already gone through the first three steps. All of those steps are to the allocable amount. It's like if you're calculating your taxes and you're taking tax deductions against your adjusted gross income. And then at the end of all of that, you have your adjusted gross income. Now is when you apply the tax credit to reduce your actual tax liability, not the adjusted gross income. And that's the distinction here. And ERISA was largely based on the tax code in this respect. And that's how it was that's how it was intended. And I would point out, I see I'm over my time.
That's okay, because I've got one more question, so keep going.
I wanted to point out, since you're getting into the math, that was one of the main points I wanted to make today, is that mathematically, and this is a bold claim, I guess, mathematically, the statute does not work at the second adjustment when you apply the credit as part of the second adjustment. And I will explain why very briefly if you want me to, because if we look at...
Because you're way over your time and Judge Newsom wants to ask you something, so...
Did you say I...
Go. I said do it quickly.
Okay. In 1386... A, it says the amount of an employer's liability for a partial withdrawal before the application of sections 1399 and 1405. That's before the application of steps 3 and 4. So 1386A is indicating right there, this is the step 2 adjustment, because it's going to create the amount that exists before steps 3 and 4. It goes on to say it's equal to the product of, and it sets forth a formula. The formula is the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits adjusted by step 1, so it's referencing all the steps, multiplied by a formula that makes it a partial instead of a complete. It has to be equal. Now, if you throw in the credit, whether the credit is a penny or $100 million, that formula does not work anymore. The amount will not be equal to the product that comes from that formula. It will be off by whatever the credit is.
All right, let me
use
it as
a question.
Mine will be quick, I think. So 1381 B1C, the cap, right? Adjust it as this runs to Judge Brasher's recipe question, I think. So you adjust it to the extent necessary to reflect limitation on annual payments under 1399C1B, all right, right? So then when you look at 1399C1B, it refers to something called the employer's liability. It says the employer's liability shall be limited to the first 20 annual payments. Is that the same thing as withdrawal liability or no?
No, Your Honor. That I would liken it to, it's referenced also in step 2, which I just read from, where it says the employer's liability for a partial withdrawal before the application, but before steps 3 and 4. It's the same thing. You're in step 3, so it's sort of a...
Like an interim or something.
Yeah, it's like when I'm doing my taxes on TurboTax, up in the corner it shows my tax liability as I'm entering deductions and this and that. But that's not the final number. It's only final when I go through all of those steps. Then I get my tax liability. Now is when I apply the credits. And it's the same thing. That liability that's referenced there, Your Honor, in the course of calculating withdrawal liability, should be viewed as like contingent or unrealized. It's not a final number. And that's why I think the argument that I make about the math and it not working when you add the credit in, that's irrefutable just as a matter of math, whatever that number is.
Okay, you've answered my question.
Thank you. I'll sit down then because I'm over, but I do appreciate that.
Sure, you've got your time for rebuttal left. How do I pronounce your last name?
I pronounce it Anspach sometimes, Anspach. But usually that works.
Anspach is good, whenever
appreciate
you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, William Ansbach with Friedman and Ansbach, representing the RWDSU Pension Fund. The fund respectfully asks that you affirm the judgment of Judge Axon enforcing the arbitration award in favor of the fund. I would just note that every adjudicator who's looked at this issue, the arbitrator and the district court, in the Quad Graphics case, the Ninth Circuit, Judge Axon, the arbitrator below, has agreed with our position, found the statutory language unambiguous.
I know, but that's not a lot. I mean, in the world of, like, telling a panel, like, hey, you've got this weight of authority, three of those are in this case, so.
Okay, well.
I mean, it's sure. Something. The other side doesn't have anything, so, you know, three is better or four is better than zero, but it's not like seven circuits have come out the same way on this thing. There's very little out there. And it's a knotty problem, I think.
That's fair to say. I think that Judge Axon's analysis did reinforce the clear meaning of the statutory language when she found that the reduction for the prior partial should take place at the second step. And I think I'd like to emphasize, following up on the previous discussion, that 1381 should be complete. It should be a complete determining, all-inclusive determination of withdrawal liability. And in that vein, as was discussed previously, the second step refers generally to 1386. It doesn't specify 1386A, which would be the current partial calculation, or only 1386B, the prior partial. The further, as Judge Axon pointed out, Section 1405 states that it applies to any part that with a lower number than 1405. That would include all of 1386. Perfection's position would sort of leave the prior partial in 1386B kind of left adrift. If it's not referenced in the second step, then it's not referenced anywhere.
Yeah, why? So why is that? Because I'll tell you, I think their best argument is this: 1381 defines what withdrawal liability is, and then 1386B gives you a credit against withdrawal liability. Why isn't that the right way to read this? I mean, that's what 1386B says. It says that you get a credit against withdrawal liability.
Your Honor, I do think that's a good. The best position that Perfection has. I think that the problem is it's not reading the language in a common sense way. And what I mean is that I'm looking at 1386B when it states that there should be a reduction in the amount of a prior partial. What's meant is that it's simply one of the adjustments that determines the ultimate withdrawal liability. And I think that is buttressed by the language in the 20-year cap. If you go back to 1399C1B, you'll notice that it refers to, it says the employer's liability shall be limited to the first 20 annual payments. There's just no way, Your Honor, to avoid referencing liability during the course of these four steps. Each step is an adjustment. Each step is a reduction that ultimately calculates the withdrawal liability. I think that Perfection gets a little carried away in arguing that, well, there's something called UVBs and something called withdrawal liability. We all agree with that. But during the course of these four steps, the UVBs are being converted into withdrawal liability. I think that...
Well, that's their point, though, that the four steps convert that to withdrawal liability. And it seems like B1 says it uses the word withdrawal liability. Any withdrawal liability of that employer shall be reduced by the amount. How are you reducing the withdrawal liability of an employer if you're using that amount to calculate withdrawal liability in the first place?
Well, you're correct. If the reference to the reduction in 1386B, it's a reduction to the ultimate calculation, then that's a problem. But in our
but that's what it says. It says withdrawal liability. I mean, that's their point, is that it uses the term any withdrawal liability shall be reduced. And 1381 is, as I think, as you just said, gives you the way to calculate withdrawal liability. So why
why don't you calculate withdrawal liability through 1381, and then 1386B says to reduce it?
Well, again, I think it's right. It's how you interpret that, the use of the term withdrawal liability in 1386B1, and that's why I was looking also at 1399, which is one of the steps. It's the third step, the 20-year cap. There's still an additional step, 1405, and yet in that third step, the statute is referring to the employer's liability.
But I guess your adversary's response to me is that employer's liability, I asked him, does that mean withdrawal liability? And he said no. He said there are two different things. Withdrawal liability is this term of art thing that is calculated pursuant to 1381. Employer's liability can be sort of interim in a way that withdrawal liability cannot. What's your response to that? Does employer's liability necessarily mean the same thing as withdrawal liability?
I think it does here in 1399. I don't know how it could not mean withdrawal liability.
Why couldn't it mean, as he says, sort of interim, sort of the TurboTax analogy, as you see your little ticker ticking down as you plug in deductions, adjustments, whatever. Why couldn't that be an interim figure in a way that withdrawal liability is not?
Well, that's, I guess our view again is with 1386B1, that's the reference to the reduction is, it's an interim step. It's part of, it, each step is a reduction, each step is an adjustment. And
I'm having trouble understanding this case. From either side, I think it's a really difficult statutory interpretation issue. One of the ways I tried to think about it, and I want you to tell me, and I'll ask Mr. Trapp when he gets back up, whether this is just so, so wrong that I should just close up shop and just go. If you're analogizing to the tax code, at step two, step B, can't you see it as a deduction and then do it at the end as a credit dollar for dollar? So that you factor it in twice, don't do violence to the statutory text because you do take it into account at step two. And in cases like, in some cases like this one, at step two, the net effect is zero because there's such large unfunded liability. But then when you get to the end, to try to provide some meaning to 1386, you then do the credit, which is dollar for dollar. How crazy is that?
Well, it sounds crazy from our perspective in the sense that the credit, we don't, so in the case of the tax code, I suppose you could.
Because a credit in tax law.
Yes.
A credit is normally better than a deduction because a deduction takes away part of your taxable income and only gives you a tax break on a percentage of the deduction.
Right.
Right. If you have $100,000 of income and you get a $10,000 deduction, you're getting taxed on $90,000, and whatever tax bracket you're in, you multiply that by the $10,000, and that's the break you're getting. But if you're getting a $10,000 credit, then you first do the tax on the $10,000. Let's say you're in the 25% tax bracket. You're paying $25,000. A credit wipes $10,000 off of that liability, so you're left with $15,000. And so I'm wondering whether or not credit should mean that dollar for dollar benefit at the end, as your opponent is saying.
Right. Well, I think, first of all, the I would return to an earlier point, which is just that if that's what Congress intended, they should have said somewhere in here there's an additional step or an additional adjustment instead of presenting it as if it were the complete determination of withdrawal liability. But in terms of the credit, I think, going back to the perfection wants to look at these particular circumstances and say, this is unfair. We could have paid less if there were different, there had been a complete withdrawal in 2016 or 2018 without a previous partial. And I mean, every situation will be different. In some cases, the 20-year cap will not be present. For example, if there's a mass withdrawal, or if the payout schedule doesn't require 20 years, there the partial credit will have enormous significance. In other cases, it could be that the partial credit is so large that it will obviate the need for the 20-year cap. But there's no guarantee that the employer will get the benefit of both. I mean, we our actuaries tell us, why is it a 20-year cap? Why not a 25-year cap, a 30-year cap? I mean, this is a huge benefit for
what,
the...
What do we make, if anything, of the letter from the board?
The opinion letter?
Yep.
Well, I one point I would note about the opinion letter, it does call the partial credit an adjustment. Now, of course, it disagrees with our position, but, I mean, that shows that it's not so clear that there's a distinction between an adjustment and a reduction. But I think under the Skidmore analysis, it should only be given weight if it's persuasive. We don't think it's persuasive.
Right, so I want to know why you don't think it's entitled to sort of anything. Why is it wrong on its face?
Well, because it states without really any analysis that the credit or the prior partial will be applied after the conclusion of the four steps, and we just think that doesn't hold water. There's no, it shouldn't be given deference if there's no real analysis.
Wasn't that the way it was calculated initially here? And then somebody objected or said something and then it got recalculated?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. Because of the timing of the Ninth Circuit decision, it is true that there was an initial calculation. Following that opinion letter, there is testimony in the record from, I have a reference here if you need it, but from an actuary who stated that the opinion letter was not the only way it could be done, but it is true that that approach was generally followed. There's no denying that it was generally followed prior to the Quad Graphics Ninth Circuit decision. Your Honor, I also wanted to point out just briefly, the perfection argues strenuously that there's an accord between 1386A and 1381B1B. And we would note that a couple of things, that 1386B uses the phrase in the case of, just like 1381B1B. 1386A uses the term in the case of only for partial withdrawals that are a different category from the one that was present here. Those are 70% decline cases. We have a partial cessation. That phrase doesn't appear there. I'd also note that both 1386B and 1381B contemplate the same set of circumstances, a partial followed by a complete or a partial. So there is some accord between the that suggests that it's not improper to place 1386B within the second step of 1381B1B. I think that was all I had to say for now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Ronsbach.
Yes, thank you.
Your Honor, first I'd like to point out that I did state or tacitly agree that maybe this was an unusual amount of unfunded vested benefits. I didn't mean to concede that this amount is anything that's this is not an unusual amount. Like, this happens all the time.
It's a large amount, but it's not
unusual. It's a large, yes, that's it, Judge Brasher. It's very large, but it's not anything that's not known in the industry. The unfunded vested benefits, you're not responsible for those. And I'd point your honors to Section 1382, which specifically says, right after 1381, and it lays out that formula, it says, when there's a withdrawal, the fund is to determine the withdrawal liability, notify the employer of the withdrawal liability, and collect the amount of the withdrawal liability. The statute only authorizes a fund to collect withdrawal liability, not unfunded vested benefits. And that is the difference, and that is why the credit reduces the amount that would otherwise be paid, which is how normal people think of a credit. If I had a credit and went into a store and they said, well, we're going to take it against the original price, not the sale price, I would object and say, take it against the price. Well, you're already saving money because we had it on sale.
But that doesn't mean that theoretically you can't place a credit somewhere other than the bottom line. Because if you, again, I'll go into the dangerous territory that Judge Brasher started with numbers. But if you start out with 10, and after step one, you're down to 8, okay? And then at step 2 or B, you get the credit, and the credit is 2, you're down to 6. And then down the line, it does help you. So the fact that it's a dollar-for-dollar credit doesn't mean it has to be at the bottom end, theoretically, right? It could be at some other step as long as you get a benefit from it. Well, your point is that you don't get it here, but you don't have to place a credit anywhere else.
Well, the only place here, Your Honor, I would point out that you can place it is after the withdrawal liability, because that's what the statute says. You apply it, shall be reduced, is what it says about withdrawal liability. You don't have that number, you don't have that amount until you've gone through those four adjustments to the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits.
Let me give you a hypothetical that I think will work, but maybe not, I don't know. So it's a law firm. So the law firm is, partner profits shall be determined by the total firm billings, adjusted by associate salary, cost of rent, and other miscellaneous costs. Have miscellaneous costs reduced partner profits?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that they have, in some indirect sense, yes.
Yeah, so I think that's right. I think that's right. Isn't that the same thing? If that's right, then doesn't applying this the way that your friend on the other side is suggesting reduce the withdrawal liability in the sense that this credit, even if applied at step 2, reduces withdrawal liability, even though the number it's reducing from is unfunded, I mean, I forget the name of it, but is the other word. Isn't it still reduced, unfunded vested benefits, isn't it still reducing that?
No, Your Honor, because that the withdrawal liability amount doesn't exist until after those four adjustments.
Yeah, but see, I gave you that hypothetical because that's a normal human thing that you could use real words instead of these made up words. And it seemed like, when I write that hypothetical out, partner profits are the total billings adjusted for these things. Seems like those things reduce the partner profits, right?
Indirectly, yeah. But
indirectly.
But if the example was you have a credit from a prior year against the partner profits, or you have some carryover that is added to the partner profits, then you would go through those adjustments to determine the partner profits for that year, and then add or subtract the partner profits from the prior year.
I now understand a little bit more. I think this case is about whether there should be an indirect reduction or a direct reduction. Is that fair, do you think?
I never did finish answering Judge Jordan's question about how the credit is illusory. If the credit is smaller than the 20-year cap, which is going to apply no matter what, that's a given. And if the credit is smaller than that, then it's entirely eliminated. If the credit is larger, then it's substantially eliminated by whatever amount was above the 20-year cap, and the 20-year cap will no longer apply. You're putting those two adjustments in conflict. And I would point out that this is probably, I mean, I know there was the Loper-Bright decision, but this is a good opportunity to look at how the federal agency that actually recommended and drafted this statute for Congress and how they foresaw it at the beginning. The opinion letters that they came out with at the beginning were right after the statute was passed in 1982 and 1985.
Did you know they misspelled the word first? As
yeah, I thought it said Frist. I thought maybe it was Senator Frist.
I guess I just have a difficult time giving a lot of deference to an opinion letter that doesn't even spell the word first right. Is that unreasonable?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And normally I'm not one that's saying let's defer to the bureaucrats. But here they actually got it right. And I would point out that the...
You know, when it helps you.
Well, there is a fundamental difference. The Third Circuit has ruled in C&S Wholesale Grocers that there's a fundamental difference between withdrawal liability and unfunded vested benefits. And I know that my area of law is very small and it's this niche, but every person that does this recognizes the fundamental difference between withdrawal liability and unfunded vested benefits. And when a credit says that it applies to reduce withdrawal liability, that's what it should do, particularly when it only applies, that second step only applies in a partial withdrawal. That language is key for showing Congress, referred to 1386 as a whole, but that language indicates that it only meant the parts that actually reduced the allocable amount of unfunded vested benefits, not the actual withdrawal liability, which is the only amount that an employer is liable for. Credit should reduce that amount. I ask Your Honors to consider all these arguments and hopefully restore some level of sanity to this area that existed before the Ninth Circuit came in and issued their opinion. And the final point on that, Judge Brasher, you said you wouldn't defer much to an opinion that says frist instead of first. If you take a look at the Ninth Circuit opinion that started all this mess, they actually say at the beginning of their opinion, Section 1381B1 establishes how an employer calculates its withdrawal liability. And every pension lawyer in America started snickering at that to say, if employers calculated their own withdrawal liability, none of us would be worrying about this. We don't. And that's how it goes over a lot. It went right over the Ninth Circuit's head. And I think if you delve into this and grab that fundamental difference, you'll see that the credit should be applied against the withdrawal liability. I thank you for allowing me this time.
Thank you both very much. We're in recess until tomorrow.
All rise.